Hi, this is Peter Bart, and you're listening to the Sound Architect podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Sound Architect podcast. I am your host, Sam Hughes, and as you just heard, I am joined today by composer Peter Bart. Thanks for joining me today, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And it's a pleasure to have you on the show. So before we start talking about The Waterman, I wanted to ask, how did your journey into music composition begin?
It began a long time ago. If I'm really honest, it goes back to the eight-year-old kid with the Star Wars LP in his hands.
Oh, nice.
And I remember there was a television show in Belgium, and it was called Premiere.
Oh, yeah?
And the first thing that really got me was like when I saw a little expert of Koyaanisqatsi, a little experts of Star Wars, E.T. That was really like, wow. Because my dad was a classical trained musician. He was a principal of a music school. And we couldn't listen to any pop in the house. That was strictly forbidden. It couldn't be on the hi-fi, but it could break his speakers. So film music was accepted. but being brought up in that classical environment, it attracted me very much, film music. And I really started listening to a lot of these scores that I grew up with. Later on in life, I rebelled against my dad.
Of course, as we all do.
And yeah, and I went into electronic music.
Nice.
So I went to film school, I studied sound, and I had a lot of friends who were in electronic music. So I stepped into that and really found like a home there. And then made two albums. But there was always this link with classical and also that search of classical music. But then being in rebellion mode, I went into the atonal stuff and modern classical music, and that wasn't accepted either. It was the great bees at home, Beethoven and Bach. But that was my path. I went on in electronic music. And then at some point, being much older and after my mom got sick, I really thought, this is nonsense, you know. And the really moment that I decided to reconnect to the classical side of my upbringing was when I saw There Will Be Blood and Johnny Greenwood's score. That was really like, oh, yeah. But then I started to study. And I of course, by then I had my studio in advertising. And that took a lot of time, so I had to do it at night, an online school. So I started to study orchestration, composition, counterpoint. And that really brought me back to the classical side that I was brought up with.
Amazing. And what was it like transitioning back to the classical side from electronica?
Because I was making a lot of music for commercials, but then I started doing these movies almost for free. Because you can say, yeah, I want to be a film composer, but if you never scored a movie, you will not know what it will be. And when my second daughter was born, I took like 6 months off of work. I took a little sabbatical, and I engaged in an independent movie for no budget, but just to do it. And there, when I was working on it, I really had a strong connection, like, wow, this is it, you know, this is it. Making music to picture, to story.
Nice.
And I kept doing that for the same director. I made then his second movie and his third movie just to get into the flow. And then I had my first Belgian bigger movie, Facades. And that was a whole other conversation with the directors. And every project you learn, I started to do some television, and it's always nice, you know, to have that conversation with the director.
Yeah, nice. Did you ever try to score for imaginary films, if you will, or existing films already to begin the practice for it? Like, how did you start envisioning scoring a movie?
from 2012 on, I think until 2016, I did a lot of Berkeley online courses.
All right.
And there you have every week an assignment. It's nice because 1 week you have to make a comedy, next week you have to make a horror.
Yeah, really, it's a good mix.
Yeah. And I always write in function of something. Also in advertising, you always write in function of a little story or a little briefing.
What would you say was one of the biggest things you noticed when switching to wanting to write for film music? What was the kind of first thing that was maybe like a big lesson for you?
Well, the big lesson was coming from that advertising side and always having making the solution. When I did Facades and I saw the image, I was so arrogant of not listening to the temp score. Like, oh, I have this.
Yeah.
And I made like almost the whole film already before the first meeting. I went into the first meeting and we talked like for an hour on the first cue. And I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be something different.
Yeah, it's very different to advertising, I can imagine.
Yeah. Because advertising is more about form and film music is more about story and content. It's really storytelling.
Yeah, and emotion and connection.
Yeah. But that really put me with my feet on the ground.
Mm.
And then I listened to the temp again, because I really like rejected the temp before and I said, oh, I don't need the temp. But then I listened to the temp, not so to copy it, but just to see what the temp does to the story and to certain scenes. The temp is a sort of conversation with your director also and with your editor.
Yeah.
They're trying to say
it's
something.
It's the bridge, right? Between you and them, yeah, to understand what they want.
Yeah. And also to understand how they want to talk, how they envision the movie.
I'm really curious with temp tracks, because temp tracks are always like a hit and miss or a controversial subject, shall we say, because some composers hate them. But how do you take a temp track and kind of analyze it for what you need from it?
Well, it's a difficult one. And it also depends how old the temp track is, you know, if the temp track, or is it already seen by the producers? Is there already been like a friends and family screening with the temp, then it's going to be more difficult to get loose from it, because they really have like this temp love going on.
So many people are used to it already.
Yeah. But if you're in your conversation with the editor and the director and there's some temp, then you can really look like, what is it doing that I don't see at this point? What is it?
Yeah.
How is it helping the scene? How is it helping the storyline? I love to be with all the indie films that I did and also with The Waterman. Actually, I came in pretty early on script and I love making my own temp, as to speak.
Oh, okay.
You know, that you already make music on the script. I'm now working on a project, a TV series, and I already have like 40 minutes of music because it's just based on the script. And they put in temp as well, you know, but it's just to add the color that I haven't thought of.
Yeah.
But the fundamentals are more or less there already. And strangely enough, that's happened on the Waterman.
Oh, nice.
So I met David here in my studio. He needed to record something. He was here in Brussels to film the Les Misérables, the BBC.
Oh, wow.
And he needed to record an audiobook for Spot the Dog for Penguin Books. And just that day, I did a session with, because we had an engineer who was ill. So I stepped in and we started talking between takes and in the breaks. And he gave me his email because I said, look, I'm really interested in doing film music. And we talked about his work. So when I saw this storyline on IMDb, I sent him an email. Look, I really feel that I should be part of it. Can I make a demo? And he sent me the script. And then I really took my time to work on the script. So I made all the main themes. One for the main character, Gunnar, for the mother, for the father, for the waterman self. The waterman rhyme was in there. But that was all demo, you know. It was just a wild card. And I sent it to him and he said he liked it. But at some point, another composer was involved. And then a month after that, they said, look, we really like the opening song that you've written. Can we buy that? And so I was like, okay. that was that for me. And then like 9 months later, David reached out to me and said, can we talk? Because we keep coming back to the demo. And it really works. So when I got into the project, the film was like stamped with my own music. They've put my half-hour demo all over the movie.
Awesome.
So I could start building on the themes that I have already written in the demo phase.
That's amazing. And so when you wrote the music for the script, were you given any sort of brief for the music at all? Or did you just read the script and go, hey, this is what I think?
I didn't know anything. I even thought at some point that it was an animation film. It was just a script, just a story.
And they didn't tell you anything about what they wanted from the music or?
No, we didn't. At that point, we didn't talk. I just did what I thought the story needed.
Fantastic. And they loved it.
David kept sending me these emails like, I can't stop listening to it. So that was really fun.
That's awesome. What was it like coming back 9 months later, though, after you've written it and thought, okay, well, that's the end of that. And then he comes back and goes, actually, could you do the film?
That was a really nice moment because I was sitting here in my studio. My wife was sitting also with me here. And afterwards, we were both crying because it's such an impactful. With David saying, are you ready for this? And I said, look, I've been waiting 20 years for this phone call, so yeah, I'm ready.
I've been ready for a while.
Yeah.
Amazing. So after you came back onto the project then, and he was like, okay, let's do the rest of the movie, what did you get from David in terms of guidance for the music? Did he just give you feedback on your score as you went through, or did he say, okay, now you're on, what we want is we want this kind of score, we want this sort of music, or... Did he give you anything from then, or did he just give you free rein?
No, so I immediately went to Los Angeles to see a screening and to watch the movie with David. And then he invited me to his home, so I stayed like a week with him. Mm. So I was a lot with him in the editing room and in his car, and we talked a lot about the films we liked, about what he wanted to do. With the story that it has an emotional value, but the adventure part is also there. So we really talked it through in those days that I was with him. And then when I came back, I really started working on that knowledge. I really started elaborating on the themes that I've written and writing new stuff for other characters. But it was really a very nice conversation between me and David. I also worked with an interface QDB where I put the cues on, and then he really always got his feedback, and I sort of arranged my day that I could working on a late time, but have like two feedback moments per day.
Yeah.
So when I woke up, I had the feedback, and before I went to sleep, I had some feedback and that was like a nice biorhythm. to Bean. And I really feel that David guided me through the whole process. He was always very constructive and very gentle with his feedback. If I thought I was completely beside the thing, he was just, no, you're in the zone. And he was in LA and I was in Brussels, but it was really close collaboration. You know, it's different than when you work in like in advertising. It's a totally different. There's so much respect, and there's so much trust.
Yeah.
Because okay, he really took a big leap in choosing me. You know, it's he really felt the music was right for his film, and that's really something I'm very grateful for that he did that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And how many do you remember? How many minutes of music you ended up writing for the film?
In total, we have 86 minutes, I think.
And so what would you say was the kind of trickiest part of writing? Because is this your first full film score?
Not full full film score, but first American Hollywood film score.
Yeah, first Hollywood debut. So as a first Hollywood debut, what was it like in terms of writing for this movie? It's kind of a different world than the indie films and everything else, right?
It is, but I also wrote with that in my mindset that it has to, if I'm doing an adventure, it has to be really adventure and really have a solid sound. In some ways, my background of electronica also helped me doing that. That merge between the classic and the electronic world is in the score, even if it sounds at some points classical and adventurous, but there's a lot of things happening electronica underneath that. So I think that's that merge of these two worlds. So I had to go from my dad. I had to go to music school.
Oh, yeah.
There was no choice. You had to go because he was principal and every kid should go to music school. So I chose to do percussion and drums in music school.
Nice.
And then later on, when I rebelled against him, I kind of lost that. But now in this film, I really reconnected to that as well. I hired some timpani. I hired some African marimba and a classical marimba. I had these concert toms here, so I did all the percussion myself.
Oh, wow.
Besides the smaller percussion, I had a guy in here, Frédéric Malompré, and he came in with like a whole package of very little percussion things, nice Japanese wood blocks.
Lovely.
And he also played through the movie. But all the bigger percussion is either programmed by me or played by me. So that's also some reconnection with the past that happened in this film.
Yeah. And how many musicians were involved in the end?
Well, we were planning to go to Budapest and have like, I think, 50 players. But yeah, then the COVID thing happened.
Obviously, yeah.
And then they reopened the editing and we worked a bit on that. But then in May, they really wanted to have the soundtrack recorded. And Matt Dunkley, my orchestrator, he said, look, maybe we should go to Galaxy and just work with 9 players. We had 4 violin, 2 woodwinds and 3 brass. And they were all in separate rooms. And we recorded layer on layer on layer to get the bigger sound.
Nice. Yeah, so you kind of had your virtual orchestra in the end.
Yeah. It felt a bit like recording a band because you really could say, oh, that violin part, oh, we're just going to punch in that, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, you don't have the blend that you have like in a big room.
Yeah.
It's a real headache to mix everything, but I think Patrick Lemons of Galaxy really did a good job in mixing everything. But it's a different way of working, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And with regards to all the themes that you wrote, like we mentioned before, you wrote Gunner's theme and the Mother's theme and the Waterman theme. How do you decide on the instrumentation? And, you know, how did these ideas come to you? How did you think about Gunner's theme in the beginning? And how did you put that together and go, okay, so we're going to have it piano-centric and this is going to happen and that's going to happen? How did you get to that point?
What I wanted to do with Gunner was really create this honest sound. And also, like the sounds that surround you when you're that age. And for me, that's a lot of little wood blocks. That's a lot of the recorder, you know, the flute. I played it myself in a lot of cues. But that sound is for me connected to that kind of age range.
Yeah, it's almost that fantasy kind of age, right? The imagination and...
Yeah. Because at that age, you know, you're in that world. You hear some external factors that may threaten you, but basically you're in, oh, let's go play in the woods and let's see what happens.
Yeah.
That's what I did at that age. And I think every kid should have that possibility to do that.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to evoke that feeling. Then for the emotional part, I tend to go to piano.
Yeah, I have to admit, piano and strings are always kind of the go-to for the heart pullers, right?
But then also, because I also did a lot beside the normal percussion, I also tapped a lot on my piano. And there's a lot of things happening on snares with prepared piano.
Oh, cool.
In there. Also, David wanted to have some more African-sounding instruments in there.
Right.
We have like this mbira and some kalimbas, but there's never one instrument that really takes the lead.
Yeah, they all have an equal footing.
Yeah. It's all part of the sound palette, yeah.
Nice. Speaking of the sound palette, this is something we talk about a lot on the show, and a lot of composers kind of bring up the sound palette that they put together for the film or for the score. How do you draw the line? How do you build the sound palette?
Actually, when I came back from Los Angeles, my starting point, I love deep bass and I love pads, really big pads. And
yeah.
In my own electronic music, I always make them myself with instruments or board piano. So I was in the screening there, and I saw this actor playing the Waterman, and he had this really deep voice, and he made this long sighs and whispers, and I thought, that's cool. So I asked them, can I have all the non-dialogue takes of that actor? And they sent it to me. And that's the first thing that I did, was making a Waterman synth.
That's awesome. So you made pads and stuff out of his voice?
Yeah.
That's cool.
So that's all coming from voice takes that I put delays on and granular synths and Eurorack stuff. And
oh, amazing.
And then edited all in Pro Tools, making these samples and putting it in contact. And that gave me a nice palette to put some bass underneath everything.
Yeah.
And then David really liked that. And he said, wouldn't it be cool to do that as well with the mother? But of course, we didn't have any Rosario Dawson size or something.
Any non-speaking takes.
Yeah, but I work often with Judith Alcon, who is a singer here in Belgium, and she has some Nigerian roots, and her timbre of voice really matches Rosario Dawson. So I got her in the studio and we sung these long notes. And I did basically the same thing with her.
Very cool.
And that gives that motherly comfort sound around you. And that I used every time was when Gunnar is in the forest and she's like with him. And that flows through the whole score. And also whatever works. I have a scene where they're further in the wood and there's a little bit more tension, and I added in like this sequenced Juno 60 bass, who's underneath, who goes through a filter. Then suddenly that's part of the deal, because it works and it gives me the nice rhythm to flow through several scenes that are interconnected. It's a bit whatever works, but of course you have to keep it in the same movie. And that was the biggest challenge for this one, because you have really emotional parts in the movie and you have really adventurous parts. And I had to keep them all connected.
Awesome. So in terms of other projects, can you tell us anything at all about what you're currently working on?
Well, I'm working on this Belgium primetime series. It's called Lost Luggage, and it's a fictional series about the aftermath of the attacks at Zaventem in 2016.
Oh, wow.
So it was early in the morning that the terrorist attack happened in the airport. And a lot of luggage was left. And there was one task force who was assigned to get all the luggage back to the survivors or the family of people who got killed in the attacks. I only read the script. They're filming now, and it's really it's really cool. A cool series about the backdrop of that whole thing.
Yeah, I can imagine that being very emotional. Can you tell us a little snippet about what the score will be like?
I really got a taste, but I'm working the main character at some points. She's without breath, and I'm now making these soundscapes where I have this breathing going on with the female, and it really works well. It gives you a really intense atmosphere without being too on the nose with rhythm or anything. It really takes you in that moment.
Oh, wow.
But I'm still sketching, you know. It's
of course, yeah.
Yeah. And then an agent from LA reached out to me.
Ah, cool. That's awesome news. Congratulations.
Yeah. So I said, yes, of course. And we're going to work together. And it's...
Of course, yeah.
But actually, it's really mind-blowing because it's the agency where John Williams is.
Yeah.
And,
wow.
And James Newton Howard and Terrence Blanchard. And
that must be incredible after all that journey of having the Star Wars vinyls.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm looking forward. What's gonna happen? We just agreed to work. So let's see what happens there.
Yeah. Well, we wish you very good luck.
Thank you.
And sadly, I'm drawing to my final question on the show, which can sometimes stump a few people. If you could go back in time and give your composer self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Well, it's a tricky one because you've done your part that you've done, you know. I could say go to conservatorium and study everything you can, but I didn't do. But it's funny that you say that because I was thinking to make a little post on my Facebook about this. I would like to go to that 8-year-old kid in his room in at the seaside in Belgium with that Star Wars album in his hand and say, look, it's all going to be right, you know. One day you're going to be at the agency where John Williams also is.
Man, that'd be so cool.
Yeah, just hang in there. It's coming.
Just keep going. Amazing. Well, I have to say it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, Peter, and I hope we get to speak to you again soon in the near future.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
No worries. Take care. And thanks everyone for listening. Hi everyone, this is Sam. Thanks for listening to the Sound Architect podcast. And I really hope you enjoyed listening to that episode. If so, there are many ways you can show your support for the show, whether it be financially on our Patreon, which is patreon.com/sounddesignuk, or whether you're just getting in touch on social media. We love to hear from our listeners. What's your favorite episode? Who would you like us to speak to? Just let us know. You can pretty much find us anywhere on the internet, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, or anywhere else. And until then, catch you on the next episode.